He says, if one tells them of babies being carried in from the cabinet by women, of young girls with live forms, yellow hair and short stature, of old women and men standing in full sight and speaking to us, of half-grown children seen, two at a time, simultaneously with another form, of costumes of different makes, of bald heads, grey hair, black shocky heads of hair, curly hair, of ghosts instantly recognized by friends, and ghosts speaking audibly in a foreign language of which the medium is ignorant, how their equanimity is not disturbed. The credulity of some scientific men, too, is boundless, or they would rather believe that a baby could lift a mountain without levers, than that a spirit could lift an ounce. But apart from the extreme skeptic, whom nothing will convince and who would label the angel Gabriel at the last day as an optical delusion, there are some very natural objections which an honest novice is bound to make, and an honest believer to answer. What about these costumes? Whence come they? Can we accept the 9-foot lance as being a spiritual object? The answer lies, so far as we understand it, in the amazing properties of ectoplasm. It is the most protean substance, capable of being molded instantly into any shape, and the molding power is spirit will, either in or out of the body. Anything may in an instant be fashioned from it if the predominating intelligence so decides. At all such copyright answers there appears to be present one controlling spiritual being who marshals the figures and arranges the whole program. Sometimes he speaks and openly directs. Sometimes he is silent and manifests only by his actions. As already stated, such controls are very often Red Indians who appear in their spiritual life to have some special affinity with physical phenomena. William Eddy, the chief medium for these phenomena, does not appear to have suffered in health or strength from that which is usually a most exhausting process. Crooks has testified how Home would lie in an almost fainting condition on the floor, pale and speechless. Home, however, was not a rude open-air farmer, but a sensitive artistic invalid. Eddy seems to have eaten little, but smoked incessantly. Music and singing were employed at the copyright answers, for it has long been observed that there is a close connection between musical vibrations and psychic results. White light also has been found to prohibit results, and this is now explained from the devastating effects which light has been shown to exert upon ectoplasm. Many colors have been tried in order to prevent total darkness, but if you can trust your medium, the latter is the most conducive to results, especially to those results of phosphorescent and flashing lights which are among the most beautiful of the phenomena. If a light is used, red is the color which is best tolerated. In the Eddy copyright answers there was a subdued illumination from a shaded lamp. It would be wearisome to the reader to enter into details as to the various types which appeared in these remarkable gatherings. Madame Blavatsky, who was then an unknown woman in New York, had come up to see the sights. At that time she had not yet developed the theosophical line of thought, and was an ardent spiritualist. Colonel Ilcott and she met for the first time in the Vermont farmhouse, and there began a friendship which was destined in the future to lead to strange developments. In her honor apparently a whole train of Russian images appeared, who carried on conversations in that language with the lady. The chief apparitions, however, were a giant Indian named Santum and an Indian squaw named Honto, who materialized so completely and so often that the audience may well have been excused if they forgot sometimes that they were dealing with spirits at all. So close was the contact that Ilcott measured Honto on a painted scale beside the cabinet door. She was 5'3". On one occasion she exposed her woman's breast and asked a lady present to feel the beating of her heart. Honto was a light-hearted person, fond of dancing, of singing, of smoking, and of exhibiting her wealth of dark hair to the audience. Santum, on the other hand, was a taciturn warrior, 6'3" in height. The height of the medium was 5'9". It is worth noting that the Indian always wore a powder horn, which had been actually given him by a visitor to the circle. This was hung up in the cabinet and was donned by him when he materialized. Some of the Edi spirits could speak and others could not, while the amount of fluency varied greatly. This was in accordance with the author's experience at similar copyright answers. It seems that the returning soul has much to learn when it handles this simulacrum of itself, and that here, as elsewhere, practice goes for much. In speaking, these figures move their lips exactly as human beings would do. It has been shown also that their breath in lime water produces the characteristic reaction of carbon dioxide. Alcott says, the spirits themselves say that they have to learn the art of self-materialization, as one would any other art. At first they could only make tangible hands as in the cases of the Davenports, the foxes, and others. Many mediums never get beyond this stage. Among the numerous visitors to the Vermont homestead there were naturally some who took up a hostile attitude. None of these, however, seems to have gone into the matter with any thoroughness. The one who attracted most attention was a Dr. Beard, of New York, a medical man, who on the strength of a single sitting contended that the figures were all impersonations by William Eddy himself. No evidence, and only his own individual impression is put forward to sustain this view, and he declared that he could produce all the effects with $3 worth of theatrical properties. Such an opinion might well be honestly formed upon a single performance, especially if it should have been a more or less unsuccessful one. But it becomes perfectly untenable when it is compared with the experiences of those who attended a number of sittings. Thus, Dr. Hodgson, of Stoneham, Mass., together with 4 other witnesses, signed a document, "We certify that Santam was out on the platform when another Indian of almost as great a stature came out, and the two passed and repassed each other as they walked up and down." At the same time a conversation was being carried on between George Dix, Mayflower, old Mr. Morse, and Mrs. Eaton inside the cabinet. We recognized the familiar voice of each. There are many such testimonies, apart from Alcott, and they put the theory of impersonation quite out of court. It should be added that many of the forms were little children and babies in arms. Alcott measured one child 2 feet 4 in height. It should, in fairness, be added that the one thing which clouds the reader occasionally is Alcott's own hesitation and reservations. He was new to the subject, and every now and then a wave of fear and doubt would pass over his mind, and he would feel that he had committed himself too far and that he must hedge in case, in some inexplicable way, he should be shown to be in the wrong. Thus, he says, the forms I saw at Chittenden, while apparently defying any other explanation than that they are of supersensual origin, are still as a scientific fact to be regarded as not proven. Elsewhere he talks about not having test conditions. This expression test conditions has become a sort of shibboleth which loses all meaning. Thus, when you say that you have beyond all question or doubt seen your own dead mother's face before you, the objector replies, "Ah, but was it under test conditions?" The test lies in the phenomenon itself. When one considers that Alcott was permitted for 10 weeks to examine the little wooden enclosure which served as cabinet, to occlude the window, to search the medium, to measure and to weigh the ectoplasmic forms, one wonders what else he would demand in order to make assurance complete. The fact is, that while Alcott was writing his account there came the alleged exposure of Mrs. Holmes, and the partial recantation of Mr. Dale Owen, and that this caused him to take these precautions. It was William Eddy whose mediumship took the form of materializations. Horatio Eddy gave copyright answers of quite a different character. In his case a sort of cloth screen was fixed up, in front of which he used to sit in good light with one of his audience beside him holding his hand. Behind the screen was placed a guitar and other instruments, which presently began to play, apparently of their own accord, while materialized hands showed themselves over the edge of the screen. The general effect of the performance was much the same as that of the Davenport brothers, but it was more impressive, inasmuch as the medium was in full view, and was under control by a spectator. The hypothesis of modern psychic science, founded upon many experiments, especially those of Dr. Crawford, of Belfast, is that invisible bands of ectoplasm, which are rather conductors of force than forcible in themselves, are evolved from the body of the medium and connect up with the object to be manipulated, where they are used to raise it, or to play it, as the unseen power may desire that unseen power being, according to the present views of Professor Charles Richer, some extension of the personality of the medium, and according to the more advanced school some independent entity. Of this nothing was known at the time of the Eddies, and the phenomena presented the questionable appearance of a whole series of effects without any cause. As to the reality of the fact, it is impossible to read Alcott's very detailed description without being convinced that there could be no error in that. This movement of objects at a distance from the medium, or telekinesis, to use the modern phrase, is now a rare phenomenon in light, but on one occasion at an amateur circle of experienced spiritualists the author has seen a large platter-shaped circle of wood in the full light of a candle, rising up on edge and flapping code answers to questions when no one was within 6 feet of it. In Horatio Eddy's Dark Essay Tilde Copyright Answers, where the complete absence of light gave the psychic power full scope, Alcott has testified that there were mad Indian war dances with the thudding of a dozen feet, and the wild playing of every instrument simultaneously, accompanied by yells and whoops. As an exhibition of pure brute force, he says, this Indian dance is probably unsurpassed in the annals of such manifestations. A light turned on would find all the instruments littered about the floor, and Horatio in a deep slumber, without a trace of perspiration, lying unconscious in his chair. Alcott assures us that he and other gentlemen present, whose names he gives, were permitted to sit on the medium, but that within a minute or two all the instruments were playing once again. After such an experiment all further experiences a and there were very man you seemed to be beside the point. Short of wholesale and senseless lying on the part of Alcott and the other spectators, there can be no doubt that Horatio Eddy was exercising powers of which science was, and still is, very imperfectly acquainted. Some of Alcott's experiments were so definite, and are narrated so frankly and so clearly, that they deserve respectful consideration, and antedate the work of many of our modern researchers. For example, he brought from New York a balance which was duly tested as correct with a published certificate to that effect. He then persuaded one of the forms, the Squahonto, to stand upon it, the actual weights being recorded by a third person, Mr. Pritchard, who was a reputable citizen and disinterested in the matter. Alcott gives his account of the results, and adds the certificate of Pritchard as sworn to before a magistrate. Hunter was weighed four times, standing upon the platform so that she could not ease her weight in any way. She was a woman 5 feet 3 in height, and might be expected to register about 135 pounds. The four results were actually 88, 58, 58, and 65 pounds, all on the same evening. This seems to show that her body was a mere simulacrum which could vary in density from minute to minute. It showed also what was clearly brought out afterwards by Crawford, that the whole weight of the simulacrum cannot be derived from the medium. It is inconceivable that Eddy, who weighed 179 pounds, was able to give up 88 of them. The whole circle, according to their capacity, which varies greatly, are called upon to contribute, and other elements may in all probability be drawn from the atmosphere. The highest actual loss of weight ever shown by Miss Gilliar in the Crawford experiments was 52 pounds, but each member of the circle was shown by the dials on the weighing chairs to have contributed some substance to the building of the ectoplasmic formations. Colonel Alcott also prepared two spring balances and tested the pulling power of the spirit hands, while those of the medium were held by one of the audience. A left hand pulled with a force of 40 pounds. And the right hand with 50 in a light which was so good that Alcott could clearly see that the right hand was one finger short. He was already familiar with the assertion of the spirit in question that he had been a sailor and had lost a finger in his lifetime. When one reads of such things the complaint of Alcott that his results were not final, and that he had not perfect test conditions, becomes more and more hard to comprehend. He winds up his conclusions, however, with the words, "No matter how many skeptics carny battering against these granitic facts, no matter what array of exposers might blow their tin horns and penny trumpets, that Jericho would stand." One observation which Chilcott made was that these ectoplasmic forms were quick to obey any mental order from a strong-minded sitter, coming and going as they were willed to do. Other observers in various essay-copyright answers have noted the same fact, and it may be taken as one of the fixed points in this baffling problem. There is one other curious point which probably escaped Chilcott's notice. The mediums and the spirits who had been fairly amiable to him during his long visit turned suddenly very acid and repellent. This change seems to have occurred just after the arrival of Madame Blavatsky, with whom Chilcott had struck up a close comradeship. Madame was, as stated, an ardent spiritualist at the time, but it is at least possible that the spirits may have had foresight, and that they sensed danger from this Russian lady. Her theosophical teachings, which were put forward in a year or two, were to take the shape that, although the phenomena were real, the spirits were empty astral shells, and had no true life of their own. Whatever the true explanation, the change in the spirits was remarkable. So far from the importance of my labor being recognized and all reasonable facilities afforded, I was kept constantly at a distance, as though I were an enemy instead of an unprejudiced observer. Colonel Chilcott narrates many cases where the sitters have recognized spirits, but too much stress should not be laid upon this, as with a dim light and an emotional condition it is easy for an honest observer to be mistaken. The author has had the opportunity of gazing into the faces of at least 100 of these images, and he can only recall 2 cases in which he was absolutely certain in his recognition. In both these cases the faces were self-illuminated, and he had not to depend upon the red lamp. There were 2 other occasions when, with the red lamp, he was morally certain, but in the vast majority of cases it was possible, if one allowed one's imagination to work, to read anything into the vague molds which rose before one. It is likely that this occurred in the Eddy Circle indeed, C. Massey, a very competent judge, sitting with the Eddies in 1875, complained of the fact. The real miracle consisted not in the recognition but in the presence of the figure at all. There can be no doubt that the interest aroused by the press accounts of the Eddy phenomenon might have caused a more serious treatment of psychic science, and possibly advanced the cause of truth by a generation. Unhappily, at the very moment when the public attention was strongly drawn to the subject, there came the real or imaginary scandal of the Holmeses at Philadelphia, which was vigorously exploited by the materialists, helped by the exaggerated honesty of Robert Dale Owen. The facts were as follows. 2 mediums in Philadelphia, Mr. and Mrs. Nelson Holmes, had given a series of essay-copyright answers at which an alleged spirit had continually appeared, which took the name of Katie King, and professed to be the same as that with which Professor Crookes had experimented in London. On the face of it the assertion seemed most doubtful, since the original Katie King had clearly stated that her mission was ended. However, apart from the identity of the spirit, there seemed to be good evidence that the phenomenon was genuine and not fraudulent, for it was most fully endorsed by Mr. Dale Owen, General Lippitt, and a number of other observers, who quoted personal experiences which were entirely beyond the reach of imposture. There was in Philadelphia at the time a Dr. Child, who plays a very ambiguous part in the obscure events which followed. Child had vouched for the genuine character of these phenomena in the most pronounced way. He had gone so far as to state in a pamphlet published in 1874 that the same John and Katie King, whom he had seen in the essay-copyright dance room, had come to him in his own private offices and had the dictated particulars of their earth life, which he duly published. Such a statement must raise grave doubts in the mind of any psychic student, for a spirit form can only manifest from a medium, and there is no indication that Child was one. In any case, one would imagine that, after such an assertion, Child was the last man in the world who could declare that the essay-copyright answers were fraudulent. Great public interest had been aroused in the essay Tilda Copyright Answers by an article by General Lippert in the Galaxy of December, 1874, and another by Dale Owen in the Atlantic Monthly of January, 1875. Then suddenly came the crash. It was heralded by a notice from Dale Owen, dated January 5, to the effect that evidence had been laid before him which compelled him to withdraw his previous expressions of confidence in the Holmeses. A similar card was issued by Dr. Child, writing to Alcott, who after his Eddy investigation was recognized as an authority. Dale Owen said, "I believe they have been latterly playing us false, which may be only supplementing the genuine with the spurious, but it does cast a doubt on last summer's manifestations, so that I shall probably not use them in my next book on spiritualism. It is a loss, but you and Mr. Crookes have amply made it up." Dale Owen's position is clear enough, since he was a man of sensitive honor, who was horrified at the idea that he could for one instant have certified an imposture to be a truth. His error seems to have lain in acting upon the first breath of suspicion instead of waiting until the facts were clear. Dr. Child's position is, however, more questionable, for if the manifestations were indeed fraudulent, how could he possibly have had interviews with the same spirits alone in his own private room? It was asserted now that a woman, whose name was not given, had been impersonating Katie King at these essay Tilda Copyright Answers, that she had allowed her photograph to be taken and sold as Katie King, that she could produce the robes and ornaments worn by Katie King at the essay Tilda Copyright Answers, and that she was prepared to make a full confession. Nothing could appear to be more damning and more complete. It was at this point that Alcott took up the investigation, and he seems to have been quite prepared to find that the general verdict was correct. His investigation soon revealed some facts, however, which threw fresh lights upon the matter and proved that psychic research, in order to be accurate, should examine exposures with the same critical care that it does phenomena. The name of the person who confessed that she had personated Katie King was revealed as Eliza White. In an account of the matter which she published, without giving the name, she declared that she had been born in 1851, which would make her 23 years of age. She had married at 15 and had one child 8 years old. Her husband had died in 1872, and she had to keep herself and child. The Holmeses had come to lodge with her in March, 1874. In May they engaged her to personate a spirit. The cabinet had a false panel at the back through which she could slip, clad in a muslin robe. Mr. Dale Owen was invited to the essay Tilda Copyright Answers and was completely taken in. All this caused violent twinges of her own conscience which did not prevent her from going to greater lengths and learning to fade away or reform by the help of black cloths, and finally, of being photographed as Katie King. One day, according to her account, there came to her performance a man named Leslie, a railroad contractor. This gentleman showed his suspicions, and at a subsequent interview taxed her with her deceit, offering her pecuniary aid if she would confess to it. This she accepted, and then showed Leslie the methods of her impersonation. On December 5, a mock essay Tilda Copyright Answers was held at which she rehearsed her part as played in the real essay Tilda Copyright Answers, and this so impressed Dale Owen and also Dr. Child, both of whom were present, that they issued the notices in which they recanted their former belief, a recantation which was a staggering blow to those who had accepted Dale Owen's previous assurances, and who now claimed that he should have made some thorough investigation before issuing such a document. It was the more painful as Dale Owen was 73 years of age, and had been one of the most eloquent and painstaking of all the disciples of the new dispensation. Alcott's first task was to sift the record already given, and to get past the anonymity of the authoress. He soon discovered that she was, as already stated, Mrs. Eliza White, and that, though in Philadelphia, she refused to see him. The Holmeses, on the other hand, acted in a very open manner towards him and offered him every facility for examining their phenomena with such reasonable test conditions as he might desire. An examination of the past life of Eliza White showed that her statement, so far as it concerned her own story, was a tissue of lies. She was very much older than stated, and not less than 35 years, and it was doubtful whether she had ever been married to White at all. For years she had been a vocalist in a traveling show. White was still alive, so there was no question of widowhood. Alcott published the certificate of the chief of the police to that effect. Among other documents put forward by Colonel Alcott was one from the Mr. Allen, Justice of the Peace of New Jersey, given under oath. Eliza White, according to this witness, was so untruthful that those to whom she spoke never knew when to believe her, and her moral reputation was as bad could be. Judge Allen was able, however, to give some testimony which bore more directly upon the matter under discussion. He deposed that he had visited the Holmeses in Philadelphia, and had assisted Dr. Child to put up the cabinet, that it was solidly constructed, and that there was no possibility of any entrance being effected from behind, as alleged by Mrs. White. Further, that he was at USA Tilda copyright dance at which Katie King appeared, and that the proceedings had been disturbed by the singing of Mrs. White in another room, so that it was quite impossible that Mrs. White could, as she claimed, have acted an impersonation of the spirit. This being a sworn deposition by a justice of the peace would seem to be a weighty piece of evidence. This cabinet seems to have been made in June, for General Lippitt, an excellent witness, described quite another arrangement on the occasion when he experimented. He says that two doors folded backwards, so as to touch each other, and the cabinet was simply the recess between these doors with a board over the top. The first two or three evenings I made a careful examination, and once with a professional magician, who was perfectly satisfied that there was no chance of any trick. This was in May, so the two descriptions are not contradictory, save to Eliza White's claim that she could pass into the cabinet. In addition to these reasons for caution in forming an opinion, the Holmeses were able to produce letters written to them from Mrs. White in August, 1874, which were quite incompatible with there being any guilty secret between them. On the other hand, one of these letters did relate that efforts had been made to bribe her into a confession that she had been Katie King. Later in the year, Mrs. White seems to have assumed a more threatening tone, as is sworn by the Holmeses in a formal affidavit, when she declared that unless they paid a rent which she claimed, there were a number of gentlemen of wealth, including members of the Young Men's Christian Association, who were ready to pay her a large sum of money, and she need not trouble the Holmeses any more. $1,000 was the exact sum which Eliza White was to get if she would consent to admit that she impersonated Katie King. It must surely be conceded that this statement, taken in conjunction with the woman's record, makes it very essential to demand corroboration for every assertion she might make. One culminating fact remains. At the very hour that the bogus essay Tilda copyright dance was being held, at which Mrs. White was showing how Katie King was impersonated, the Holmeses held a real essay Tilda copyright dance, attended by 20 people, at which the spirit appeared the same as ever. Colonel Alcott collected several affidavits from those who were present on this occasion, and there can be no doubt about the fact. That of Dr. Adolphus Felger is short, and may be given almost in full. He says under oath that he has seen the spirit known as Katie King in all perhaps 80 times, is perfectly familiar with her features, and cannot mistake as to the identity of the Katie King who appeared upon the evening of December 5th. For while the said spirit scarcely ever appeared of exactly the same height or features two evenings in succession, her voice was always the same, and the expression of her eyes, and the topics of her conversation enabled him to be still more certain of her being the same person. This Felger was a well-known and highly respected Philadelphia physician, whose simple word, says Alcott, would outweigh a score of affidavits of your Eliza White's. It was also clearly shown that Katie King appeared constantly when Mrs. Holmes was at Blissfield and Mrs. White was in Philadelphia, and that Mrs. Holmes had written to Mrs. White describing their successful appearances, which seems a final proof that the latter was not a confederate. By this time one must admit that Mrs. White's anonymous confession is shot through and through with so many holes that it is in a sinking condition. But there is one part which, it seems to the author, will still float. That is the question of the photograph. It was asserted by the Holmeses in an interview with General Lippitt, whose word is a solid patch in this general quagmire, that Eliza White was hired by Dr. Child to pose in a photograph as Katie King. Child seems to have played a dubious part all through this business, making affirmations at different times which were quite contradictory, and having apparently some pecuniary interest in the matter. One is inclined, therefore, to look seriously into this charge, and to believe that the Holmeses may have been party to the fraud. Granting that the Katie King image was real, they may well have doubted whether it could be photographed, since dim light was necessary for its production.